This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez, and the morning run begins.
Good morning, Sharad.
Good morning. It is the 18th of September, and we have a fabulous lineup for you all throughout the morning. But we'll begin with some news that we had, of course, not just overnight, but over the weekend, because we, of course, just come out of a reasonably short weekend. We're looking to a long weekend at the end of this week, though, aren't we, Brian? With Awal Muharram taking Friday as a public holiday.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are looking forward to another long weekend.
Yeah, one of many, it seems. Okay, over the weekend, of course, we had images coming out of Penang of chaos caused by flooding, because this is related to typhoons that hit central Vietnam and Laos and dumped record levels of rain in Northern Peninsula. I believe Penang had as much rain in one day as it usually has in a month.
Well, because of rain as well, last night Lewis Hamilton won the Singapore Grand Prix and he used wet conditions to his advantage. He's of course, known as the Rainmeister, just like Michael Schumacher before, and he performed very, very well.
Oh, is that what he's known for? Yeah. Okay. Well, Trump also, this is related, of course, to extreme weather conditions that we had, of course, Hurricane Harvey and Irma pummeling the southern part of the U.S. Donald Trump, the President of the United States, says he might stay with the Paris Accords on climate change just hours after the White House insisted there would be no change in U.S. policy. So I don't know if he's doing this just to annoy people that work for him or because he's now had a change of heart.
Well, I hope he has had a change of heart, but the UN has not. UN has issued a warning to Myanmar on the Rakhine situation, but has not constituted any concrete actions against the Aung San Suu Kyi government.
Yeah, so what's happened there, I guess, is that they say that they might declare this a situation of ethnic cleansing. The question is what kind of sanctions would follow from such a declaration. All the same, the 14th World Chinese Entrepreneurs Convention kicked off on Saturday in Yangon with over 2,000 overseas Chinese businessmen gathered there under the theme "An Opening Economy in Myanmar, A New Epoch in History."
Yeah, I was quite surprised about that, Sharad, when you said that Myanmar actually hosted that event. It's a very big event, rotated around the world, obviously, in areas where there's lots of Chinese entrepreneurs. Interesting that it's being held in Myanmar this year.
Well, there's a significant Chinese community, ethnic Chinese community in Myanmar, as well as the fact that the Myanmar is being courted as part of China's, you know, look for more markets as well as resources. They're also building there's a possibility at least of a pipeline that goes towards the Bay of Bengal from Yunnan. So all kinds of exciting possibilities for entrepreneurs when they're looking at new markets. It's a huge country.
Yeah, and now moving on to the U.S., new protests have broken out in the U.S. city of St. Louis, where a white former policeman was found not guilty of murdering a black suspect in 2011.
Yeah, and of course, we've had all kinds of news coming out of the U.S. in terms of that kind of racial conflict. Remember that viral video that went around where a policeman says to a somewhat terrified white driver, he said, "Well, we only kill black people, so you don't have to be afraid." So that's the United States of America for you. We're going into Steeler's Wheel, Stuck in the Middle with you, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Steeler's Wheel and Stuck in the Middle with you. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez. It's the 18th of September, and it's coming up to 8 minutes past six in the morning. Now, Brian, because, you know, we talk endlessly about the big disruptors in the economy, and we're looking at everything from ride sharing apps to the Airbnbs of the world, right? And many of the people behind it have been celebrated for being rule breakers and people who thought outside the box. Now, some of them have come to a bad end. Martin Scorsese, Travis Kalanick, and such. And so the question is, why did they rise so fast and why have they also fallen? And some suggestions, some theories behind it have to do with the kind of mindset that led to their success are also being behind their sudden departure from the stage.
Yeah, so research by economists Ross Irvine and Yona Rubinstein have said that people who become entrepreneurs not only apt to have very high self-esteem but growing up, but also Lauren Steinberg, a Temple University professor, also cited a phenomena of moral disengagement in which people rationalize their behavior, which are at odds with their own principles.
Well, you know, so the example would be that you think, that you say, it's given in the article which you're about to tweet out, which is that you steal a pair of sneakers and then you tell yourself that the manager was overcharging the customer. So you allow yourself to break rules because you believe that there's something inherently flawed in the system that you're going up against.
So in this case, so let's talk about the Silicon Valley and disruption. People with these traits look at things that are happening, the norm, as an opportunity to break things. So the celebrated Facebook mantra, move fast, break things. And Mark Zuckerberg basically typifies that example. He has character flaws in his own, of his own.
Who doesn't?
Yeah, absolutely. And also rule breaking is part of the whole equation. Travis Kalanick, was never engaging of governments. In fact, they were pushing boundaries constantly. And but look how big an organization he built.
Yeah. So they break rules, but only to establish new rules and new rules which favor them. So it's not that they're against rules as such. It's just against the current set of rules that limit their ability to maneuver or, in this case, make humongous profits.
Correct. But the thing is, here's what's happened. As they break the rules, they set new norms, but not necessarily new rules.
Well, they do set new rules. Yeah. I mean, the new rules are there in the laws that govern the regulation of these new systems of, you know, public transport and such. I mean, the thing is, they also lobby rulemakers in order to establish those new rules. So it is new rules.
No, but the thing is, that's part of the whole equation of breaking the old rules. Now,
yeah, they're not rule breakers. They're not against rules. They're just against the rules that limited themselves.
No, but in order to break existing norms and to innovate, I see the point that these guys have to go and break the rules. They will then, as you say, perhaps temporarily set new boundaries or set new rules for the next lot of guys to come in and break them.
Well, maybe, but I think if it's going to affect their bottom line, they're going to be pushing back on that. Because after all, they're there not because of an ideological commitment to break rules. They're there to make money. That is the bottom line for all these guys. And, you know, when they cheated taxi drivers in New York, when they, you know, created these algorithms that, you know, gave taxi rides the riders, the passengers, one set of costings as opposed to the drivers, that was also breaking the rules. But no, that was cheating.
That was dishonest. Now, let's not lump all of them together that way. Travis Kalanick, in some instances, obviously there was elements of dishonesty.
Yeah, and how do you disaggregate the dishonesty from this now triumphant idea of rule breaking?
Well, the thing is,
because what is dishonesty but to break rules, right?
No, not at all. I think
dishonesty is not breaking rules.
No, dishonesty doesn't. Breaking rules is not dishonesty, but dishonesty not necessarily is breaking rules.
How is that?
No, so the thing is this. So
when you're dishonest, you break norms of human relationship, yes, that you should never lie. That's a rule. I mean, the Ten Commandments are a set of rules, aren't they?
So let's give an example. Let's take ride sharing as a whole. If we had such poor taxi system, we have a much better transportation system now.
Yeah,
so because they've broken the rules.
Yeah, so you can, of course, have all kinds of processes to change a legislation and change rules that govern how society works. You don't have to do it through disruptive technologies.
But think about it. We've been suffering, just talking about ride hailing, we've been suffering with terrible taxi system for years and years and years. There was no redress. Hey, within 3 years, look what the rule breakers have done.
Yeah, so we'll celebrate that for sure. We'll be back with more after this. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, John Cougar and Jack and Diane. I'm Sharad, and with me, Brian Fernandez. And the Morning Run continues. It's coming up to 20 minutes past 6 on the 18th of September.
Yeah, so this recent article yesterday on the Financial Times talked about hedge funds being run by women have actually generated returns 2 times higher than their main counterparts this year.
Male counterparts.
So the HRX Human Index, which pulls together the performance of female hedge fund managers, returned 9.9% in the first 7 months of this year, and compared to 4.81% of HRFI funds weighted composite index, a broader reach of funds, which is basically predominantly run by men.
You know, Brian, this conversation that's in the industry suggests that, and it's a long-standing one, about the dominance of men and also white males, right? So it's not just that they're males, but they're also white, so they have a ethnic-specific character as well, that they dominate much of that industry. And the question is, why hasn't diversity really kicked in? And there have been many studies to show that some 1.1% of asset management firms are run or controlled by women and minorities. So it's not just women, but minorities as well. And that when they look at performance, they find that these firms are run by minorities and women tend to be in the upper quartile in terms of performance. So there is already a good argument just based on data that the otherwise mainstream firms should be hiring more women, should be hiring more minorities, but it's not happening.
But one of the things with that, Sharad, is also this, because there's such a small number, one of the reasons where the results could be skewed in a positive manner is the fact that these people must be exceptional to get to that level. Because there's such a small number of them in the industry, they have to break a lot of barriers to get hired in the first place or to run these funds. So they're really the creme de la creme, really, of this industry. And yeah, that probably explains why the performance is really so good.
Maybe. I think there's this other thing that isn't, at least in some of the articles I've read, that suggests that women-directed asset management funds tend to are more or 36% more likely than those run by men to be invested in passive funds, so funds that track indices. So that also is another reason. So I think when in this conversation, they're trying to get beyond the sheer, I think, the kind of the ideological commitment to diversity to something more kind of grounded in data.
I think in terms of the industry itself, obviously the data shows that it isn't a very diverse industry. And one of the challenges facing the fund management industry now is returns have actually fallen over the last few years, whereas fees, there's pressure on fees then to reduce fees as well. And part of the reason for that is actually groupthink. Everyone's the same, they're white males, therefore they're doing the same thing. So how do you beat the market? So one of the ways actually, and that's a craze across the board in terms of industries and companies, if you have greater diversity, you're more likely to perform better, to see different opportunities, to see new opportunities, to take different approaches because there's different ideas.
You know, sometimes we talk about Malaysia and the diversity we have here as a strength. It's often said in a very positive way. It's affirming of the multicultural, multi-faith, and multilingual character of Malaysia. But I wonder to what extent this is true of corporate Malaysia. You know, how much a corporate Malaysia reflects that diversity. And also to throw in the mix, apart from language, race and religion, also gender.
Yeah, because you would find that I think Malaysia is quite progressive in that sense. There are a lot of women in senior positions, particularly in the financial services industry, strangely enough, in Malaysia. However, in terms of ethnic diversity, you see some firms dominated by certain ethnicities only, unfortunately.
Well, next up, we have Garbage and their song Special, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, with me Brian Fernandez, and that was Elton John, I'm Still Standing. It's coming up to 39 minutes past 6, because it's the 18th of September. We also, we had a little panic over the weekend, yesterday in fact, when the Prime Minister called a press conference drawing many senior members of his party back to Kuala Lumpur. I believe that his deputy was in Perlis and cut short his visit there. And there was a lot of talk that we were going to have the announcements for the next general election. It didn't happen, but what it did demonstrate is the way in which the you know leaders of this country, as well as politicians in the federal opposition, think about communications, right? Why call kind of a sudden press conference for such a small announcement, which was the return of a former member of UMNO back into the fold? And it reminds me, Brian, of an earlier incident when, in fact, the Prime Minister was in Washington, D.C. for a visit there, when Pakatan politicians called also a press conference and put on wigs. They put blonde wigs to demonstrate. Well, I'm not quite sure what they thought they were demonstrating.
Well, the thing is, so they put out wigs during a press conference essentially to mock U.S. President Donald Trump and Najib's visit. Didn't they realize that it was just a cheap shot at the Prime Minister? And,
but the question is, who would have thought so, right? So I think the idea with every communication is it goes to various audiences, and the target audience might think this is great fun. And those who are not the target audience might think, well, not so great.
Yeah, exactly. Who was the target audience for this? I am just kind of appalled by this whole thing because you expect more from your politicians.
Do you? I would like to hope so. I'm not sure what I expect from politicians. I must say, I think there is, and because I follow, you know, because I'm on Twitter, I know that mockery is a mode of dealing with, you know, present concerns, the question of the future in terms of the political configuration. And there's so much mockery. I myself indulge in gentle mockery on Twitter.
All the time, don't you?
Yeah. You know, on you follow me on Twitter, do you? Okay, so lucky you. So you, and because it's partly funny, I think some of the gentle mockery or even the harsher types of mockery can be quite funny. And so the idea was it's humor, right? And I think Malaysian politicians have gotten into this habit. I think it's particularly pronounced among the federal opposition.
Well, you see, that's your side of the equation. There's another side of the equation that says, hey, you know, the opposition politicians try to take the high moral ground in general. They try to uphold themselves to a higher standard, but then actions don't speak the same language as what they're trying to achieve.
Because you think that by doing this, you know, by engaging in this kind of, you know, sort of gestures, you know, that they somehow diminish their own authority?
I think so, because I'd like my politician or my parliamentary representative to take a high moral ground, to represent my interest, to be a serious person.
So you like the sobriety, is it, in the expression of political concerns? So because I think there are a lot of people who feel that, you know, and maybe even politicians feel they're constantly, you know, vying for people's attention. They're going to have to do something occasionally, something silly in order to get the attention of the population.
So let me give you an example. My representative is actually Tan Sri Sharil, Felda Global Chairman. I think he's an excellent politician.
In Johor Bahru?
Yeah, in Johor Bahru. And I have a very high regard for him. I mean, really, somebody that you look up to as a politician, I think as a person of integrity. So I don't think he's going to be indulging in shameless mockery like as these guys have done in the press conference.
Okay, we'll leave it to that. If you want to join this conversation at any point in time, because you can tweet us at BFM Radio, that's BFM_radio, or you can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Tell us what you think of the things that politicians do and say. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Stevie Wonder and Once for Once in My Life. I'm Sharad Kutan and Brian Fernandez, and it's coming up to 48 minutes past 6, the 18th of September.
Sharad, there's an interesting article in the Edge Financial Daily today online, which talks about poverty driving Malaysian women to work as maids. So low wages and increasing costs of living are driving Malaysian women to look at being maids as an employment alternative. So a company has started called My Local Maid in May, started by a 43-year-old lawyer to supply Malaysian domestic workers. And this is really primarily for people in Terengganu and Kelantan for a start. And their wages, there's a minimum wage set of 1,000, and it can go up to 1,005 for depending on the scope of the job.
You know what is interesting about this? Because there was a time when a lot of domestic workers were, in fact, sourced locally. And, you know, often they came from the ranks of the working class, people from estates.
Yes.
And, you know, and trying to find a way out of the particular kind of economies that they were in. And then there was a time when you couldn't get people like that because these young, especially women, were going to look for work in factories, and factories were paying enough, not the basics, but perhaps with overtime, they were paying much more than what you would get working for a domestic helper in a local household. But that obviously has changed somewhat, and I'm wondering to what extent this story and the fact that there's a take-up for this particular company, My Local Maid, signals shifting employment opportunities and wages in, you know, the Malaysian economy.
No, one of the things, Sharad, is actually the following. The sheer cost to middle class and up families of employing a maid. So first of all, there's the cost.
So on the other side. You're talking about the family
side.
Yeah,
and then you see the cost driver and how the opportunities really could be in terms of income. So it costs you about 15,000 to 18,000 for just on fees alone for maids to come out from overseas. And then there's the issue of salaries, which now are above 1,000 ringgit as it is for maids.
What would lead people? I mean, to want to work in. So what? Why would young local women? And this story is interesting, but it also refers to graduate women seeking such jobs. That's got nothing to do with what families are willing to pay or why they would rather pay a local as opposed to a foreigner. It's got to do with the lack of opportunity for such women.
Lack of opportunity is one issue, but actually the wages that could be paid could be substantially higher than, say, for example, minimum wage or for them working in an office.
Well, 1,000 to 1,500 is close to the minimum
wage. So let me tell you the actual cost of, say, hiring a Filipina. If you actually cost everything out, and I used to have a couple of Filipina maids, essentially that would cost you, I costed it out, food cost and all, direct and indirect cost, between 2,500 and 3,000. And I've always said I'd rather employ a local person.
But if there's no there's no supply. So this was there was no supply because factory jobs were aplenty. Overtime at factories was sufficient to create wages that were reasonably high that actually made domestic work unattractive.
But
now become attractive because you don't have those opportunities.
Not only that, Sharad, I think it's also the stigma associated with being a domestic maid, and also the long potential hours. But if we look at it from a context that it is a job where somebody starts early in the morning and then leaves the home perhaps late in the evening, then it becomes a normal job which they perhaps don't have to live in.
Well, you know, and that's in fact not the situation of most foreign domestic workers. They worked 24/7 with very little leave. Now, correct. What is interesting about this endeavor, My Local Maid, is that it in fact gives 60 days of paid leave to those who live with the family. They, in fact, are live-in maids, as foreign workers, foreign domestic workers are. And it gives them, 15 days of
sick leave
as
well.
That's
right.
So those conditions are much higher than those that would be given to foreign maids as well.
I would be happy to employ someone local under those conditions. Because, again, I think the bigger issues as well, it's socially and culturally easier to probably have a local maid as opposed to somebody, say, from Bangladesh or from Indonesia, who are culturally quite different from us.
Well, I think the question of cultural difference is interesting because it's being promoted as something where there are no cultural differences. Of course, somebody who's local, you know, might share quite a number of things in common with the families they work for. But the question of cultural difference doesn't end there, right? Because there will be religious differences, for instance, and sensitivities around that. So if you imagine, you know, people from different faith communities living and working in the same space, you might have those differences, even if they're all Malaysian, right?
No, of course. So I suppose in this case, for example, the company has matched Muslim local domestic maids with Muslim employers. Perhaps that's one of the ways to address that issue that you've just talked about.
Yeah, and also the question of, you know, the conditions in which I think a lot of foreign domestic workers live in, something that a lot of locals will not accept. The confinement, the lack of boundaries, all that is something, and I think on the employer side as well, they're going to have to learn that they can't treat maids as, you know, 24/7 workers.
Sharad, I've always had a problem, even as a teenager, in the way that we treat our foreign domestic workers. So I think there needs to be a fundamental shift.
But is it going to happen? I mean, you might be the exception rather than the rule, don't you think, on that?
I think there are a lot of people like me out there who want to treat their domestic helpers
but what
better.
Happened? But how do you do that when somebody lives with you 24/7?
They're part of your family.
Well, that's another way of saying, well, we can exploit them. I don't know. When you say part of a family, does it mean you stop asking them to wash your cups at a certain time of the day?
Yes, I think that's it. Because I'll give you an example. We have helpers with, say, my sister, my parents and all that. After a certain point, on Sundays, they don't do any work, for example. They get the day off. After a certain time, no washing dishes stuff.
Oh, I see. So they get it Sunday every day, every week.
Yes.
Oh, that's very progressive. Okay. Next up, Lenny Kravitz, It Ain't Over Till It's Over. BFM 89.9. Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Brian Fernandez, and the morning run continues. It's just after 6 minutes past seven. It's because the 18th of September. Now, we ended last week, Brian, on a really sad note with the death of all those students and two teachers at a Tafeh school or a religious school in the Klang Valley. But towards the end of that week, remember the fire broke out some early in the morning Thursday, but by Friday we already had indications as to why this fire had broken out in the first place. And, you know, initially there were some concerns that it resulted from an electrical fire. It was an electrical fire.
But that was quickly discounted?
It was eventually discounted when it was discovered in a CCTV image of a stranger at the back of the school or around the school compound alerted the police to a possible new line or thread of evidence. And so what happened over the weekend was that on Friday, some seven kids aged between 11 and 18 were arrested. And it's now turned out that they were involved in setting that fire off. And because of some dispute, some name calling that happened over a futsal game. Now, the question, of course, is the case is now closed in terms of the source of the fire. And the individuals are being investigated for murder, mischief by fire, sudden death, and such. The other side of that story remains, Brian, which is the question of the safety of the building. We know from reports that the building was a temporary shelter as the school was being built. But nevertheless, temporary or not, the safety features of that building and an escape route that was blocked, I believe, sets up a whole series of other questions about the possibility of criminal negligence on the part of the school. Now, we spoke to Zuraya AR, assistant news editor of the Malay Mail, last week, to get his insights about why religious schools are given leniency in the context of building safety, which was a question that was first raised by Dato' Sri Johari Abdul Ghani, MP for Titi Wangsa.
The comment by the MP suggests that the government has been very lenient with this sort of private religious schools before. I think it is not so much that we are now trying to become more lenient. It's just that I think we have to understand that these schools, it operates in parallel with our current mainstream education system. So it is sort of like a black hole that not many authorities have an insight into, because they are not operating according to the national guidelines and so on. So I think that is one thing, but I think there is also political baggage that comes with scrutiny or perhaps criticism against religious schools, especially when it is private. I think there is no political expediency to do so, and there is no political gain to be received by criticizing anything that is related to the status quo religion. And instead, you would perhaps receive backlash instead if you try to be more critical of anything that is related to the issue.
That was Zurairi AR, Assistant News Editor at Malay Mail. I mean, he points out also, and I think this is a somewhat unpopular, and he says of himself, it's unpopular opinion, when it comes to the question of why parents keep sending their kids to such religious schools that are in fact unregulated and seem to bypass much of the safety criteria that is demanded of others.
Okay. This might be an unpopular opinion, but I think parents should stop sending their younger children going to these private religious schools, especially Tafi schools, where the small children are living in a fully boarding system with such squalid and very miserable conditions. I think it is very unfair and very selfish of the parents to just simply ship their children off. In a way, they are trying to contract taking care of their children to this very questionable system. You can see in the news reports, some are as young as 7 years old. They should be in school, in proper schools, in our national education system. So these young children, not only are they being deprived of their education, but they are also, in a way, being sent to their death and to face abuse, as evident in many of the news stories that we have reported before.
That was Zurairi AR, Assistant News Editor at the Malay Mail Online.
Sharad, I think, and I'm a believer that all religions, you should send your children for religious education. I think there's no issue about that. What I think is so important is the just safety. Whatever schools it is, you must have your children studying or attending schools which are safe. You never put your children in harm's way.
I don't think that the parents actually meant to, and then perhaps the parents assumed that the school authorities would have checked off all the requirements, and this is the real issue. Without being regulated, it's then an act of faith. You expect the school to do it, whereas with other schools which are regulated, which come under the Ministry of Education and other authorities, the expectation is not unfounded, because you expect that there is another authority overseeing the school.
Yeah, but wouldn't Bomba and the associated authorities regulate any sort of building, that whether or not it's a religious school or whether it's a residential area, residential building? There should be a regulation on basic safety, regardless of what the purpose of the building is.
Yeah, so this whole incident has opened up a huge can of worms with regard to these Tafiz schools. Why is it that they have been, given such a kind of wriggle room to do as they please? And I think, without being presumptuous about how they're conducted, because there might be some Tafiz schools that are well run, the point is, there isn't an overarching authority. And what's happened is that, and I think Zurairi makes the point, is that people are loath to criticize the system because they think they won't benefit from it. When I say people, I mean the politicians or those in authority. There's a kind of reluctance to be critical. The question is how big the system is, how many of the adults, never mind about the teachers, but how many of the adults, what kind of influence do they wield? Are they seen as a vote bank? Do they have influence in the larger community, for which if they were regulated and they've pushed back on any attempts to regulate them, saying they don't want interference, that this might have a consequence politically? So that is, I think, the larger context.
I think the reluctance to intervene politically, I think it's a very valid one. But again, we've got to look back.
It's a valid issue.
The argument is a valid one. That's the reason for the hesitation. However, you've got to look at the sheer number of incidences. And I think we spoke about it last week. I think there have been literally hundreds of instances over the last few years.
Yeah, in fact, the Majlis Da'wa Negara came out very concerned about this and made a statement to that effect, that the number of instances are far too large for them to look away, to say that this was just an accident. They say, the question is this an issue of mismanagement? So the Majlis Da'wa Negara has come out to actually name this as a problem. So there are people who are concerned within, people of the faith, who are people in authority, who are concerned. We just mentioned the MP of Titi Wangs has already come. But it's taken, in some ways, this long to get to this point.
And this tragedy and the loss of life, let's do something good out of it.
Yeah, so the question, of course, is now that those young boys have been caught for starting the fire, will people forget several things? One, the whole issue of the Tafis schools, the lack of regulation and such, as well as the simple question that you've raised about any building needing to pass some sort of safety requirements, and also as the question that Zarari points out, which is the desirability of sending your kids full time to such religious schools and bypassing mainstream education. I think all those questions remain important, and we'll keep at it as we go along. Next up, we'll have more news and analysis, so stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.